thank you so much for giving me a chance to tell you a little bit about what we've been up to. So what we talked about was, because this is so different from most of the topics of the workshop, we thought the best thing would be to use it as a starting point for discussion for what could be done for simulations to address questions in far from equilibrium, in non-equilibrium. And so I'm just going to give you a very brief summary of sort of the main ideas of what we've been looking at. And then mostly we want to use the time for discussion. So the analytical work that I'm going to talk about has been done with Yehuda Ben Zion and Jonathan Huell. And then we have done some simulations, and I'll mention that, and comparison to some experiments. And these are the students in our group, and three of them are going to be looking for postdocs in a year. So if you want any of them, let us know. They did fantastic work. So Nir Friedman especially did most of the on the nanocrystal work, and Tyler Ernest on the granular materials. And then we have several undergrads that are currently working on comparison to experiments. So we have basically been asking the question, if you take a chunk of material and you shear it very slowly, then it's known from experiments that you get acoustic emission, or you can also measure stress strain curves which have steps in them. So for example, think of metals. The experiments I'm going to show you, are a lot of them are single crystals where people slowly compress them. And if you look at the stress strain curves, if you have large samples, they look very smooth. But if you have small samples, you can actually see that there are tiny little steps in the stress strain curve. And these steps correspond to sort of mini earthquakes where the sample just suddenly deforms because there's a region, a weak region that slips. And if you take the statistics of these jumps in the strain and look at them, so here's the number of slips versus their size, so it's a histogram, you get a very broad distribution. You don't get a Gaussian. So it's not just noise, but it's actually, it has these very broad tails. And the exponent of that distribution is universal, meaning it's the same for lots of different crystals that people have looked at. And so yes?
How are you defining size?
Uh-huh. OK, so in this case, size depends how you drive it. So if you drive it at fixed stress, we define the size as the total slip in the material. So in an earthquake, it's called the moment. It's basically the area that's slipping, or the slip integrated over the total slipping area. You could also, if you drive it by just moving the boundaries, you could also just use the stress drop that you feel upon a slip. You could use that.
That would be different.
So actually, they scale the same way. So you get the same scaling exponent. Yes, they're different quantities, but for these universal questions that we're looking at, they have the same exponents. Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah. No. Good question. And I'm glad you're asking. In fact, that's very, very important for analyzing the experiments when you look at them. So what's the right quantity for which boundary condition that you have? Yep. So you can also, in simulations, you can also do other things. So Mark has some very nice simulations on amorphous materials where they actually look at energy drops during a slip. So basically, the thing to remember is that this is far from equilibrium. So we're not just near equilibrium, but we're really way out there, far from equilibrium, driven, very slowly driven. And these are some of the open questions in this field that we're after. So first of all, because you see that different materials behave the same way, you can ask how many systems behave the same way on long length scales. So you want to know, so the fancy word for it would be the underlying universality class. In other words, you want to know, you know, how many systems actually do behave the same way, and can we make predictions for different classes of materials. So and then the next question is, can we predict these power laws and also scaling functions? And the answer is yes. You can. There's actually functions that you can predict and compare to experiment. And the reason why this is interesting is because functions have a lot more information than just power laws. And also, that's a very nice way of checking the assumptions of your underlying theory. Then I think a very interesting question also is, what's the relation between crackling noise? We call these slips crackling noise. Crackling noise and glassiness. So you know that in glasses, you are typically stuck in some thermal metastable states. And you can ask, for example, questions about if you have a glass and you let it slowly relax, you can ask, is the dynamics in that case in these glasses in any way related to the statistics of the crackling noise that you see when you slowly shear a system, so where you have driven transitions between metastable states. So remember, as we shear this, we're never in the lowest free energy state, we're always in some metastable state, and that we're just driving it from metastable state to metastable state. And you can ask, is there any relation between these two cases? And actually, we've looked, I don't think I'll have time to talk about this here, but I've looked at some models for magnets where you can actually show that you get the same scaling behavior if you drive a system with a field through a series of ground states as you get when you drive it far from equilibrium. So the statistics is the same. One case is far from equilibrium, the other case is actually in equilibrium. And the statistics of these transitions is exactly the same. So we did some large simulations on that, and there's some underlying Bermudization group theory that suggests that as well. So there's some interesting questions about the connection between equilibrium, near equilibrium, and really, really far from equilibrium.
Can I ask
Yep. Yes. Yes. Yes.
So when you say the statistics, you are talking about the wells or the barrier crossing?
Okay. Okay. So actually, I can tell you in like two sentences what that story is about. Okay. So if you think of the random fieldizing model, right, which is a model where you have spins that can be up or down, the Ising model would just be a lattice of spins that can be up or down. And in the random fieldizing model, is the same idea. These spins are ferromagnetically coupled. But in addition to that, you also have a random field, which varies from point to point, which is frozen in. So that's supposed to model some disorder. So you know that in these spin systems, when you're at low temperature, you have a ferromagnetic phase. And when you're at high temperature, you have a paramagnetic phase. And so if you take a magnetic system and you apply a magnetic field, you can align all your magnetic moments in a certain direction. If you're out of equilibrium and you now drive the system, lower the magnetic field, and then increase the magnetic field again, you get a hysteresis loop. So that's what magnets sort of, you know, recording magnets are known for, that you have these hysteresis loops. These loops are very much like the stress chain curves that I was talking about. They actually have these little steps in them, which correspond to avalanches of spin flips. It's very much the same idea. And then you can, again, ask, what is the statistics of these avalanches, of these spin flips? And so you can ask that you can ask, if you do a histogram, how often do I get an avalanche of a certain size? And the size of the avalanche would be sort of the region that flips in one go. So on this axis, I should maybe say what I'm plotting here. Here's magnetization, and here's magnetic field. And so you can show that if you look at the distribution of avalanche sizes near a critical disorder, you have a power law. So there's a phase transition that is reflected as having a power law of these step size distribution. Now, in equilibrium, you do not have hysteresis. The corresponding equilibrium curve in these Ising models looks like this. Equilibrium has no hysteresis. But if you go to zero temperature and you actually, in equilibrium, always calculate the equilibrium state and you slowly raise the field, then you get steps in the equilibrium curve as well. And if you do a histogram of these step sizes, these avalanche sizes in equilibrium, you get exactly the same exponents and scaling functions and everything that's associated with it as you got out of equilibrium. So that's what I'm saying. So basically these serrations in the magnetization curves look for this specific case, they look the same in equilibrium and out of equilibrium. You can show it by simulations, and you can show it by using realization group methods.
Is that only at the critical disorder?
So this would be at the critical disorder that you get the power law, and as you go away from the critical disorder, your power law gets a cutoff because you have a finite correlation length. But the way this cutoff changes with disorder is it has another associated critical exponent, and that is the same in equilibrium and in non-equilibrium. And also then you can do scaling collapses, you know, collapse all these curves on top of each other, and you get a scaling function, and that function is also the same in both. And then we looked at lots of other exponents and scaling functions. Everything you look at is always the same. Yeah. So we really think the two are the same. So it's basically the statistics of the noise in the, if you like to call it noise, I mean, we call it crackling noise, because it's really a dynamically driven noise. It's not temperature noise, because we're at zero temperature. But the statistics of that is the same in both cases. So that is sort of one example of where you have, the same in equilibrium and non-equilibrium as related to the statistics.
And they're seeing size
scaling. Yes, absolutely. So you can do finite size scaling. So we did, and that allows you to extrapolate to very large systems. But we did like 1,000 cube spins for these. We already went to quite large systems, but you can see that as you extrapolate, you get. But there's definitely finite size effects. That's right.
And yeah. The size effects also introduce a cutoffs usually.
Correct. Absolutely. So
both ends, by the way.
Yes, that's correct, because you have also discreteness effect. Yeah. You're exactly right. Now, the predictions that we are interested in only apply to the end of the large avalanches, where your avalanches are large compared to the microscopic details.
Yeah, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But there, you see size effects in exactly the same way.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. And so then what you do is you can simulate this at different sizes and see how the cutoff changes with the system size, and then there's a prediction for what that exponent should be, and it agrees with the prediction, and you can do that in both cases, and it's the same thing. Yeah.
Just a comment on this. This is interesting in the sense that you've just talked about there being very large universality clocks.
Yes, exactly.
And this analogy would suggest that it's actually very, very special disorder only that's critical in some sense, and therefore but many things look critical but aren't, and one might then wonder whether what looks to be critical in general isn't. But it's also true that if you do a different thing, which is what we've done, looking at interfaces moving as
yes.
opposed to the flipping,
exactly.
And for all disorders, there is critical behavior in the limit of low velocity.
That's correct. So that's correct.
So it depends a little bit on how you set up things, and I think it's interesting whether these things are somehow really always critical at zero velocity.
Ah, okay.
Or mm-hmm. whether like this, there's only some special systems that
yes.
are critical.
And in fact, it depends very much how you drive your system. So there's different ways of driving it that puts you at the critical point, so you see the power loss, and other ways where you actually have to tune a parameter to get to the critical point. In fact, I'll show you in the plasticity both cases. Yeah, very good point. But even if you just have a critical disorder, it turns out the critical region amount around that disorder is enormous. So if you go 50% away from the critical disorder, you still get 2 decades of scaling. So it seems to be like you have very large critical regions in these cases because of the quantities that you look at. So we have some arguments for why that is, but it's quite large. So for experiments, it would be interesting to have experiments tuning stress, strain rate, experiments and simulations, I was going to put that here, stress, strain rate, and temperature and disorder. So we are very much interested in comparing to both. So the next couple slides or so, I will just give you just a rough idea of this incredibly simple model that we have, and then show you that it's very successful for these universal properties, and I'll also point out which things it cannot do. The reason we wrote down the simple model was because Georgios Tsakinas, who was at the time a student in our group, he had been doing some simulations, and we just needed some intuition for how to analyze it. And so I think for simulations, these simple models are useful because they give you some intuition for what quantities to look at and why they're interesting. So in the end, actually, it worked much better than we expected. So this model has only one tuning parameter, the weakening. And then if we actually extend it to granular materials, we also have another tuning parameter, which is the packing fraction. So I'll just briefly mention that. So then there's two of them. Then we use it to describe two experimentally relevant boundary conditions, either where you shear your material by slowly increasing the stress you apply, or by having a fixed strain rate. So in these, experiments that they have with these nanopillars, Julia Greer at Caltech has some very nice experiments where she has nanopillars and she pushes down. Either you can either push down with a fixed strain rate, or in principle you can push down by just slowly increasing the stress. And then the simple model gives you exact predictions in 2 and 3 dimensions for these universal exponents, like these scaling exponents. So you can show that you don't even have to, well, okay. So so basically there's arguments why we think in 2 and 3 dimensions. For this model, it gives you the correct, but we would, the correct predictions, but we would love to compare to real simulations, not just simulations of this model. And then the predictions agree with first experiments, and there's lots of experiments, lots of predictions for future experiments and simulations. So here's the model. It's just very simple-minded. You just say you have a chunk of material, you have weak spots in the material. As you shear it, those weak spots will slip. Whenever you have a local slip, it will trigger another weak spot to slip because of the stress transfer. So you get an avalanche of slip events. That's the main idea behind it. So the way we just effectively write it down, we say the local slip velocity, so U is a local displacement, is proportional to the externally applied stress plus some interaction with the slips in the other places in the material plus some pinning stress that's supposed to model the heterogeneities in the system, which could either come from having dislocations at different places in the material or in the granular materials. It's a very heterogeneous situation. So there's going to be some heterogeneity. And then, so for example, for the crystals where you have dislocations, a weak spot would be a spot where you have a dislocation because as soon as you shear it, that dislocation wants to move along a glide plane, and that makes it weak at that spot. And so it's known how dislocations interact with each other. In fact, you know there's long-range elastic interactions. And then they're actually so long-range that you can show, using Romanization group arguments, that the mean field theory, which is the theory that where you have infinite range interactions, where they don't decay with distance at all, gives you exact results for this case, for this model. So you can actually show in the physical dimension. So you can show if you simulate this model or if you actually just solve the simple mean field theory where you just have infinite range interactions, you get the same exponents for this distribution of avalanche sizes. So this exponent tau and all these other exponents, they will be the same. To convince you, I'll show you in just a second a comparison. So here, I forgot to mention one thing. Here about the heterogeneity, what we say is we have these weak spots, and we say each of these weak spots is stuck till the local stress is bigger than some failure stress, and then it slips till it reaches some arrest stress, and then it reheals. So basically, as you load it, it only slips if the stress is bigger than some failure stress. That's the simplest version of the model. And then you can also, I said there was one tuning parameter, and that tuning parameter is this weakening. You can say, if a spot has slipped, you can say, sort of quite similar to static versus dynamic friction, if you like, you could say that locally that spot gets weaker, so you reduce the threshold and then keep it weaker till the avalanche has finished, and then between avalanches you say, it more or less reheals again. So you basically have you have this local threshold weakening, and the two cases give you different results.
So where does this epsilon enter in your equation?
So actually, in here, so this is supposed to be some pinning stress, and this would be saying that after a spot has slipped, you have a weakened threshold to failure again. So in a second, I'll show you actually how we implement the model, but that's the idea. Yeah. So yeah.
These heterogeneities are in fact fixed in the material; they don't themselves move.
That's correct. So they're fixed. But we have also studied this model where every time you fail, you give it a new failure stress, and this, it makes no difference for the exponents, for the scaling exponents.
Like SGR.
Yeah, it's very similar. That's right. So the statistics in both cases is, and the exponents should be the same. So the main idea, it's a coarse-grained model. We're not going down to the details of the material. And for example, this weakening, just to give you an idea where it could come from, in granular materials, when you slowly shear them, if you have a local slip, you typically get a local dilation. And the local dilation makes it easier to slip again at that spot. And so that's where this weakening comes from. That's basically the idea. While in crystals, we don't have that. We don't have, so in crystals, we just set this to zero, this weakening. Where we, if we have single crystals and it's just ductal, you know, deformation. So the weakening plays a bigger role if you have materials that behave more like brittle materials. And I'll show you in a minute what that does. So here's the main idea of the simple model. So first of all, here's a picture of a crystal that you shear. The idea is you have these dislocations that move through the crystal as you slowly shear it. And that would be sort of a series of slips along this glide plane. So wherever the dislocation passed, you had a local slip. And if you have such a weak spot, a local slip, then it triggers other weak spots to slip, and that leads to a slip avalanche. So over here, this is supposed to show you this. These dots that turn red, they're the ones where you say, okay, locally I had a slip, and then I can trigger other weak spots. The blue ones are supposed to be your weak spots, can trigger other weak spots to slip, and that leads to a slip avalanche. This is just supposed to show you the shear direction. It doesn't really matter in this cartoon. And on this axis, we're plotting the number of weak spots slipping versus time. So you start with one, and then the next time step you have two, and then three. That's why it goes up and then back down. So that gives you sort of a feel for the strain rate, if you like, as a function of time. And then at the end, it dies back down to zero, and that's what we call one slip avalanche. And then you have to increase the stress further to trigger the next avalanche. That's the whole idea. And now we're asking, what is the statistic? So what does a histogram of these slip avalanches look like? Here's the same thing one more time. It's just saying the same thing as I said. So basically, you have this threshold for failure. So on this axis is the shear stress. If the stress is bigger than the failure stress, it fails. And then it remains stuck while it gets reloaded, and then it fails again when the stress is bigger than the failure stress. And then you can also introduce weakening, if you like, to model more brittle materials. Or you can also introduce hardening, which is important in crystals where you can have entanglement of dislocations. In that case, you could say that threshold actually increases after slips.
Is the failure stress constant, or does it change in the course of time?
In the simplest case, we're saying it's fixed over time. But if you actually have the weakening, then we would say, yes, it changes. So after you locally slip, then actually the failure threshold gets reduced. So actually, in the case where we have weakening, we say it's history dependent. It depends on whether you had a local slip. But if in crystals, for example, we would say it's fixed. But this failure stress is random throughout the material, because we say we have some heterogeneity, and so we just use some distribution for these tau s's that's random. But sort of like I was mentioning, you could, if you have a failure, you could also say after each failure, you just pick a new failure threshold for that spot from this distribution, like in granular materials, because you say you rearranged it a bit, and it does not change the statistics of the avalanches. So it's quite robust to the exact rules of the model. So either way. So that's all that goes into the model. And so now we solve this model in mean field theory. In mean field theory, it's nice because you can just solve it analytically, and we also tested it against simulations of this model, and it agrees. So the mean field gives you the same. So just to summarize the results of the mean field theory, here is the stress strain curve in the mean field theory. And if you look close up, you actually have these little steps in the stress strain curve that correspond to these slip avalanches. So any step in strain corresponds to such a slip avalanche. And then you can do histograms of these slip avalanches. And then you find the following. Let me draw this here. So if this is your stress strain curve, so this comes back to Mark's question about having a tuning parameter. Right now, I'm talking. Remember, I was saying you can solve this model for two boundary conditions, either increasing the stress or moving the boundaries at a fixed velocity. So if you, right now I'm talking about the case where you just slowly increase the stress. And in that case, your stress actually becomes a tuning parameter. So what I'm trying to say is, if this is your stress strain curve, let's say if you would simulate, do a real simulation, where you slowly, where you compress your material slowly, and you measure the steps in the stress strain curve, and you do a histogram of those, then if you are, so on this axis is stress, on this axis is strain, and then you have these steps in your stress strain curve. If you were going to do a histogram of the slips far away from the failure point, you would get a power law with a cutoff here. It would be cut off by an amount that is related to how far you are away from the failure stress. If you take only the slips that happen closer by to the failure stress, so here up here is the failure stress, then you get a power law of your steps that extends farther out. So again, this is the number of avalanches versus their size. So the maximum size increases as you approach the failure stress, as you might expect naively. And then if you're actually at the failure stress, you get a power law all the way to the system size. And the model tells you that this maximum slip avalanche, roughly speaking, should scale like the stress minus the critical stress to the minus 2. So, and this power law should be slip size to the minus 1.5. So the model predicts what these exponents are.
In absolute value, right?
Yes. Here? You mean, yeah, but we are only approaching it from below, so we haven't really studied about,
but
yeah.
Oh, yes,
you're exactly right. You're exactly right. That's right. But there's a square, so that helps me out. So yeah, that's right. But the thing that I want to point out is what this model gets right is only these exponents. What it cannot predict correctly is where it actually fails, which is maybe an issue for applications. But you can show from the realization group that the simple model that only makes predictions on long length scales can only get these exponents right. But even that is, on the other hand, these exponents are supposed to not depend on the details of the material, while the failure stress does. So in other words, the model only gets the things right that do not depend on the microscopic details, that are more general. And those are nice things to compare to simulations, because we think they don't depend on the details. So you might set up your simulation whichever way you like, and it would be nice to compare this. You can also look at power spectra. So for example, if you would have the slip velocity or the strain rate as a function of time in these cases, you would get, or sometimes people measure acoustic emission, you get a very noisy signal. And you could take the Fourier transform, so here's, let's say, the gamma dot, for example, as a function of time. You could take the, or you could take your acoustic emission signal, and you could take the Fourier transform of this, and an absolute square that would give you the power spectra. And again, the model predicts that it goes like omega to the minus 2. So that's another thing you could easily compare to experiment to simulations. Also, this is actually very nice for comparison to simulations, because you don't really need to clearly define an avalanche. You can just take your signal, pipe it through the Fourier transform, and be done with it. So
the Smax essentially measures how far you are from the criticality?
In a way, it does.
If you have a hardening system, which you often have,
yes.
That becomes a very critical issue.
Okay, great. Yeah, so for the hardening, actually, that's a very good point. For the hardening actually is also a tuning parameter. It gives you a cutoff. So for the hardening, actually, your stress strain curves tend to have this linear part where it goes up linear for a while. I'll show you in just a second. And the statistics in there is a power law, the same power law with a cutoff that scales with the hardening.
How far you are from the actual local criticality.
Okay, so in the hardening crystal is actually a little different. In that case, okay, let me show. I'll get to that in two slides. Yeah, I'll get to that in two slides. Yeah, very good question, actually. So let me summarize so far. This was for predictions without weakening in the simplest case and without hardening, where you just get a sort of a plastic stress strain curve like this, and your deformation is homogeneous throughout the material, and you get this picture. And I'll show you. I'll get back to this in a second. Then you can also introduce weakening if you put the weakening into the model where the thresholds after each slip are weakened, then you get a stress strain curve that looks like this, where you have precursors to a huge slip. The precursors are again given by the same statistics as before, And the maximum avalanche size in the precursor scales like 1 over the Wheaton squared. But then eventually you reach this point where basically your system, your slip localizes and you get an enormous slip. So that's what the weakening does. It basically gives you, goes from a plastic stress chain curve to a brittle one, where you suddenly get this localization of slip. And then if you introduce hardening, which we can in the simple model as well, where we just say after a slip, the threshold is raised, then you get stress strain curves that look like this. They actually, and then of course eventually they fail. But there's usually a very wide region that looks more or less like this. And in this regime, actually the statistics does not depend on the stress. So in this regime, the statistics goes like s to the minus 1.5 with a cutoff that's given by the hardening. And then of course as you approach failure again, you get the stress.
And how the end rate?
The end rate. That's exactly right. Actually, rate comes into here. I was neglecting rate, saying we're going very slow, but we could stick that in, and you're exactly right. You can make predictions as a function of rate as well. That's right. Very good. And so the nice thing is those stress strain curves, again, look like the ones in hardening metals, and the statistics, the critical exponent, agrees with the one from experiments. And remember, this is just a simple, simple mean field theory. So... So here's just a summary. You have just this one tuning parameter, weakening, that gives you either brittle, plastic, or hardening materials, and it can give you predictions for these avalanche size distributions and that you can compare to simulations and experiments. You can also do, this was all for tuning the stress in the material. You can also tune the strain, the move the boundaries at a fixed velocity, and that is more, that actually gives you statistics that people have studied in detail in the context of earthquakes, because there you have those continents moving far away. It's very much like a fixed strain rate boundary condition. In fact, this whole model was originally motivated by studying earthquakes, and now we've sort of applied it to these experimental systems. So in that case, if you move the boundaries at a fixed velocity, if you have weakening, the mean field theory predicts that you get stick slip behavior, where you have a big slip and then small ones, and then again a big slip and small ones. So your statistics of avalanche sizes looks like you have a bunch of small events that again described with this s to the minus 1.5 power law, and then you have some big events, much, much larger events that are sort of these local failure events where the slip localizes, I mean huge failure events. And those are these almost periodically recurring, very large events. And in granular systems, you can see that. It's called stick slip, as you shear granular systems. And if you have no weakening in this case, where you move the boundaries, you just get back your old power law. And then then it's sort of more in this self-organized regime that you were mentioning, where you just see this power law for many different disorders. And that's actually just like in this. In your nice interface, depending for the magnets, you actually you just get this power law in all cases. It's the same thing. So then I will spare you the details, but I just want to say there's lots more predictions. You can, for example, if you have a slip avalanche, and you have enough in simulations, this is actually a very nice way of testing this. In simulations, you can crank up your time resolution easily. While in experiments, it's hard. If you have a slip avalanche, so here is the strain rate and here's the time, you can actually look at these avalanches, and they're very noisy themselves, but you can average a lot of avalanches of the same duration, so you get sort of a mean profile. And these mean profiles of the smaller avalanches are just rescaled versions of the larger avalanches. So you can do scaling collapses, and from that you can predict this entire shape of an average avalanche size, which in the mean field theory is a parabola. And that would be very nice to compare to simulations and to experiments, of course. But a lot of experiments don't have, at this point, enough resolution to actually get this. So let me just mention, well, how am I doing on time? I'm probably way over, right? Okay, I'll just make it very brief. I'll just say, how do they compare to simulations? So Giorgio Sacchini, a student in our group, he did simulations of dislocation dynamics. This is again a coarse-grained approach, because you only model the dislocations in the system. So remember, you forget about all the lattice. You just have this dislocation that moves through. And then you assume it's just an overdamped motion of these dislocations as you shear it. And you slowly shear the system, and then you have these dislocations moving. The purple dots here are the dislocations, and the background is sort of the rest of the crystals where you don't see the details. And the different shades are supposed to show you the stress. So there's actually a whole industry of doing this dislocation dynamic simulations, and this movie is actually from Carmen Miguel. This is just to give you an idea what these look like as you shear them. And you see that
2D one glide system.
Correct. Correct, exactly. So this is 2D. The assumption is that you have straight edge dislocations into the board, and they can only move along glide planes. And then you slowly shear the system. That's exactly all that goes into it. And then you just have relaxational dynamics for your dislocations. And this is with the full interaction that you know is long range rather than mean field. And so Georges simulated this and did an extremely careful job. And he, for example, he could actually calculate these shapes, these scaling functions, and they agree with the mean field theory. And he also measured all these different scaling exponents for avalanche size, duration, energy drops, you know, just different quantities. And everything he looked at agreed with the mean field theory, even though the mean field theory had these infinite range interactions and was much simpler, and this dislocation dynamics was taking into account the long-range interactions. Yes. Okay. So actually, I was going to say that next. So Georges did two-dimensional dislocation dynamics, and then there is this very nice work. So you might ask, what about climb and things like that? And so Sikor and Zapari and a few others, Zeiser. That's right, Zeiser. They did a 3D version of this, and it turned out to be the same, which is actually exactly what you would expect from the mean field theory. So the mean field theory tells you above two dimensions, you know, they should always be the same. It shouldn't make any difference. Should be mean field theory. And so they basically showed, yeah, it's true. So basically, we're confident that it's good enough to look at two dimensions. And then you can also, I really should stop, but you had this very nice talk from Jörg Rottler on phase field crystal simulations. So you could also use phase field. So Nigel Goldenfeld had a student who wrote a phase field crystal simulation, and so then Georges took that and sheared the system and looked again at the statistics, and to make a long story short, you get the same exponents for the phase field crystal simulation. And so then just to finish up, I just want to show you, because this is so cool, the comparison with experiments, and it gives you an intuition for what's going on. So Julia Greer has these nice tiny nanocrystals that they can compress. So here's the stress strain curves with the slips. And Nir Friedman in our group, he looked at, so actually what happened was we had all these predictions, and I went to Caltech. I talked to her and said, we have these predictions, can't you guys do some experiments? And she said, oh, this is fantastic, because we have all this data and we don't know what to do with it. So she gave us the data that they had for these slips in these where they slowly compressed these nanopillars. And so if you look at the statistics of these slips that is plotted here, cumulative distributions, you get exactly the exponents predicted by the mean field theory. I was hoping you wouldn't notice. Yes. Yeah, there is a long story behind this. So it's minus one. And the reason it's minus one is because two things. First of all, he's plotting cumulative distributions, while the exponents I was saying here is PDFs. But cumulative and PDF is just different by one. So you might say, why isn't it 0.5? The reason it's not 0.5 is because he's lumping together, because they have so few slips, we're lumping together all the stress or all the slips over the entire stress. We're integrating, exactly. And if you integrate the scaling function, you get actually a predicted exponent of s to the minus 1 for the cumulative. So that's why I'm saying it's consistent. So basically, that would be lumping, adding together the exponent for the cutoff, because you change the stress, and the exponent for the power law. And that gives you minus 2 for the PDF or minus 1 for the CDF. Yeah, good point. So it looks consistent. And so here is a picture of their experiment where you can actually see, in fact, you can even hear it, maybe. I should have cranked up the volume. It's true. So you see, it's a very jerky process. That's the main thing we want to get across here. And up here is the stress strain curve. So that's that. Just to give you a feel for the type of system this models. And so then basically he looked at the statistics of these steps at different stress levels. And indeed, just like in the, remember in the theory, you had the prediction as you approach failure stress, the cutoff grows. And then you did, if you do the same thing with the data, where you take the histograms of the slips in these different regions as a function of stress, you have a cutoff that grows as you approach the failure stress. And then there's these nice tools from the theory of phase transitions where you stretch these axes to collapse them all onto one. So you did that with the experimental data, collapsed them all onto one using the scaling form from the mean field theory. And then you plotted the function from the mean field theory on top of it, and it agrees. So we think the mean field theory describes these deformation of crystals. But there is a lot, so I should, there's a lot more things you can ask. So you can ask about granular materials, and so we're working on this. There's some nice experiments, I'll stop there, from Bob Berenger, where they have these particles as they shear it, and they're actually photoelastic disks. So when they're squeezed, they put like, put them through cross polarizers, and when they squeeze, they light up. So as you shear sort of this inner disk, you can see how the force chains move in the simulation, and it shows you that the deformation of granular materials is a very jerky process. And you can ask the same questions for this. And so we have some initial results looking at their data, which looks very much like what we predict from the model. So in the model, we introduced voids to accommodate that it's a granular materials, but it looks very similar. But maybe I should just stop here. There's some nice experiments by Karen Daniels, which is sort of a different way of shearing it, but the same idea where you see force chains developing. So you can ask all these same questions in granular materials. And Mark Robbins has done a fantastic job looking at similar questions in the amorphous system. So he can tell you about that. So overall, it looks very encouraging. But I should stop here. The whole goal of this was actually to raise some questions. So these are systems that are far from equilibrium. And these are some questions that I was talking with Jörg yesterday. And we sort of put together a few questions just to get a discussion started. But really, the question is, how can you do simulations of these systems far from equilibrium where you don't have to do these ad hoc models that we've sort of, these very coarse-grained models, but where you can actually model it on different scales and get information on various scales, because these models predict a wide range of scales, and it would be nice to compare that to simulations. So maybe at this point I just leave it up to you. So maybe I should say, for example, there's some questions that also were raised by the talk by Peter Davis the other day. You could ask, what about thermostats far from equilibrium? Or what about time-accelerated molecular dynamic methods? Are they useful for these non-equilibrium problems? Or what things that we learned from equilibrium can be generalized to non-equilibrium or going beyond linear response is definitely important in these strongly driven systems. So there's a lot of, I think there's a whole open field out there that needs to be explored, and we would love to see some input. Yeah, thanks so much.
Any other questions?
So what I found striking was this similarity between the random field easing model and this non-equilibrium phenomena.
Yeah.
The random field easing model, you know exactly which contribution does what, the energy, the stress, and so on, the energy and the interactions and so on. Is there something or do you see a chance of a kind of one-to-one identification?
Yes.
Between different contributions. So the polymers and statistical mechanics is simple. You know that 1 over n is the same as 1 as t minus tc over tc. And then things like this, when you map it onto the N2-0 model, so you have a kind of translation table from one way of looking at the system to another. Is there a chance to develop something in that area as well?
Between the magnets and the plasticity, yeah. You think? Yes. In fact, Mark has a very nice theory for a single domain wall. So in magnetic systems, maybe I should just put it over here. I don't know if people can see me. But in magnetic systems, you can have you can look at questions. What if you have a single domain wall? So if you have a single domain wall where you apply a field and move that domain wall forward, in that case, you can plot the velocity as a function of applied field, in this case, field or force, of this domain wall. So it would be like a single magnetic domain wall that you push forward as you apply a field, let's say, in this direction. This domain wall moves forward. Then you get a what's called a depinning transition, where below the critical field, your interface just moves and jerks. And then above a critical field, it just keeps moving at a velocity that fluctuates, but sort of it never stops. Turns out, this model that I was talking about in plasticity, can be shown that it belongs to the same universality class as this Marx interface depinning model. So for these magnets.
In a very broad sense of universality class, not the same exponents.
Same exponents.
Oh, really?
Same exponents. Yeah, same exponents. Wow. So if you do the mean field theory for this, you get the exact same stuff for this. Exactly. Yes.
So this one isn't the mean field for three dimensions, but the other one.
Well, actually, it depends on whether you have dipolar forces. That's a good point.
The dipolar.
Yes. So if you have actually dipolar forces in the magnets, then you also have long edge forces. You could show that this also actually operates in the mean field limit. But if you don't have dipolar forces, you're right. Then you get different exponents. That's exactly right. So basically, the single interface depinning with dipolar forces has the exact same exponents as this in the plasticity, and you can also check that with experiments. So that's. That's actually an amazing thing in these non-equilibrium systems. Sometimes you think, oh, non-equilibrium, may not be as universal. In these cases, in these avalanche cases, the universality classes seem to be enormous.
I think what you made also the statement before, when we compare the statistics of near equilibrium and the statistics in the rates far from equilibrium, then for both turning out the same, which you
have with that loop, yes,
that requires a certain relation between the barriers and the minima in the equilibrium system.
I agree. In fact, this is an important point. This one is not true for the interface case, that the equilibrium and the non-equilibrium are the same. It's true for, we have another model where you have many interfaces that interact. So that's really the Rahnefeld-Ising model, where you allow clusters to flip all over, where you don't just have a single domain wall. For that case, this is true that equilibrium and non-equilibrium are the same. But for the single interface, it's not.
It's not.
Yes. So you can't say that it always works. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point.
Just